Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Is it war if machines do it? And are there boundaries to war when robots are in the lead? P.W. Singer writes deeply on the realities of robotic warfare, and it's far from science fiction. The drones work nonstop in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it's not just the U.S. that's arming up on the robotic front. This hour on Point, P.W. Singer on robots and war right now. Joining me now from Washington is P.W. Singer. He's director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative and a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. His book, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century, is just out in paperback. P.W. Singer, Peter, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. This is a terrific book. I admired it when it first came out, and I've only thought about it more in the years since as we've seen this grow and grow. I wonder if we could go just first right to the latest news headlines with you. Just over this weekend, we saw an attack on the CIA base and coast in Afghanistan near Pakistan. 7 CIA officers killed there by a suicide bomber, double agent, it turns out, for al-Qaeda. The next day, flattened building or in Pakistan where we're told militants were, and that was by a drone. As somebody who follows robotic warfare, what are you making of this exchange, Peter?
Well, two things come out of this. One, when I was researching the book a couple years ago, I remember an interview with an insurgent, and this was an Iraqi insurgent who said, you know, look, if you're going to be reaching out and touching us this way, I'm paraphrasing for him, but basically, if you're reaching out and touching this way, we're going to find ways to hit you. And that's really what describes what happened in Afghanistan, where the insurgents targeted those who they thought were operating the systems. But there's a bigger point here is that basically you have two asymmetries at war here. We're using technology to operate remotely so that, in a sense, we don't have to worry about sending that letter to someone's mother, a soldier who's killed in action. And the other side's reaching out asymmetrically. That is, they're using terrorism, insurgency, suicide bombing, roadside bombing. And so you have two asymmetries at war here. It's very different than our understanding of war in the 20th century. And I guess the way to put this is that what seemed abnormal just a few years ago is the new normal in war.
Of course, I mean, people still die in the end. The suicide bomber, Jordanian, apparently died. The bodies of those 7 CIA officers have come back to Dover already and been met there. But what I was struck by was the intimacy and, you know, sort of human vehicle of that suicide bomb versus the drones over Pakistan that more and more frequently, it seems, are letting fly with the big bombs. That seems like an enormous asymmetry, but yet people die both ways. You've got a Taliban commander saying here, telling the Wall Street Journal, this was tit for tat. We did it because this was the base, he thinks, that was directing those drones, and we're hitting back.
And let's be clear here, that base in Afghanistan was not the only one. There's operations taking place out of bases, for example, in Nevada. And so what you have going on here, and this is the real point of the book, is that while people want to talk about the technology is incredible. I mean, we're talking real science fiction-like stuff. It still comes back to us. It comes back to the humans as to what's important. It's all the ripple effects. It's all of the reactions that take place in politics and society and law and ethics. That's what matters here. And that's what's interesting about it.
You advised the Obama campaign a bit on security and defense issues. Barack Obama has been very willing to use drones in Pakistan. It's very controversial there, but you know, they claim a lot of killings of al-Qaeda leaders. Pakistan claims a lot of civilian dead as well. Are you surprised by the ramp up in drone strikes over Pakistan in President Obama's first year in office?
No, not really. And basically, it's because this technology isn't a right-left issue. It's really more like a sea change that's taking place in war. A good parallel to think about it would be what happened in World War I. You know, was the airplane, which had just been a science fiction technology, was it a Democrat or a Republican technology? No, it was something that was introduced to war and started being used a lot more. And we've seen that happen here with remotely operated and unmanned systems, and as they gain more intelligence, truly robotics. And the way I think about this is that it's a seductive effect for policymakers, whether they're on the right or the left, in that they can think about acts of war but view them in a very different way because they view them as costless. And the way to think about this in a certain manner is that we no longer declare war anymore. We no longer have a draft. We no longer buy war bonds. And so the barriers to war in our society were already dropping. And now we have this technology that allows us to carry out these acts of war without having to send people into harm's way. And so it allows you to go to war, allows the nation to go to war with really without reflecting on it. And I think in a sense that's what's played out in Pakistan, where, you know, first on the tail end of President Bush's administration and now definitely in the first year of Barack Obama's administration, we have seen an amount of airstrikes into Pakistan that would have this count as a war. That is, we've had more drone strikes into Pakistan than we had manned bomber strikes in the opening round of the Kosovo war. But we don't call it a war because we view it differently for some reason.
So with robotics, in a sense, you're saying, I mean, everybody says or has said for years we're at war with al-Qaeda, but you're saying we talk about the Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, but we're at war robotically, drone-wise, in Pakistan.
Very much so. We talk about how we're America's engaged in two wars. If we're being honest about it, we're both at war and we're not. That is, we're engaged in two wars with military troops in the field. There's a third one that's essentially being run by the CIA, but the number of airstrikes is equivalent to the Kosovo war. But then it allows this weird irony where other than at the airport, our public isn't at war. And so this is a real difference maker. And then it also – another change here is it's not just for the nation. It's for the individual. That is what it means to go to war. That individual who's operating these systems – you know, one of the people who appears in the book is a commander of a Predator drone squadron. Mm-hmm. He talks about how he wakes up in the morning. He drives into work. He spends 12 hours behind a computer screen.
In the USA.
Like, yes, in the USA. He's outside of Las Vegas, Nevada. Spends 12 hours behind a computer screen, a lot like any other office drone, except he's, in his words, putting missiles on targets, killing enemy combatants. And then he gets back in the car and he drives home. And 20 minutes later, he's sitting at the dinner table talking to his kids about their homework. And so this meaning of going to war, which is held the same meaning for the last 5,000 years, is actually changing. That is, he's no longer going to a place of such danger that he might never come home again. For him, the experience of war, the danger, is actually the commute and maybe carpal tunnel syndrome.
Warheads on foreheads is the kind of terrible slangy phrase here of these things, you know, targeted from the sky, and then you're home for dinner. What's the intensity of the drone program, the, I guess, Predator program over Pakistan now, Peter?
It's we've seen the strikes, basically hitting a point of about one every week. It ebbs and flows. It very much depends on the intelligence that's available. But it's you're seeing a large amount of strikes. For example, the one that killed Massoud, who was the individual who had helped plan the killing of Benazir Bhutto, they reportedly tried 14 strikes before they got him.
Wow.
And so this is, you know, something that's a very active campaign, and it's not going away. Let's be very clear here. From one perspective, from the executive branch perspective, it's been highly effective. They've killed more than 20 al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders without having to put a single U.S. soldier into harm's way. But of course, remember, we may be talking about technology, but it's playing out in our world. So there's human effects of it, ripple effects. And one of the ripple effects that's come out of that is that, as a Pakistani newspaper described, America is enemy number one in Pakistan because of these strikes. It's not the Taliban that's viewed as enemy number one. It's us. And so this is one of those challenges is are you playing whack-a-mole with the technology? That is, it may be seducing you to do it a lot more, and you may be killing some of these leaders, but are you seeing new leaders pop up? Are you all that effective in the end?
And down come the – at once a week, it could feel like a rain of these things from Pakistan. On the other hand, Barack Obama promised and Americans asked for the government to go after the people who attacked the country on 9/11, and that, you know, we're told this is the effective way of doing it.
Indeed. And again, 20 top leaders killed without a single soldier sent into harm's way. On the other hand, just a couple weeks after they killed one of these top leaders, the organization was able to carry out one of the most spectacular terrorist strikes. And I'm not talking about the, you know, the guy on the plane in Christmas, the crotch bomber, so to speak, but rather actual bombers that entered into the Pakistani Army headquarters and killed a number of folks there. And so the point is that there's a fear among many policymakers that we may be going down a similar pathway that Israel has found itself in with operations against Hamas. That is, Israel, using the same technology, has gotten to be very effective at killing Hamas leaders. But it hasn't figured out how to keep 12-year-olds from wanting to join Hamas. And that's a similar parallel to what we may face here.
And meanwhile,
and it's not an easy answer.
You have to wonder how far back on its heels Al-Qaeda can be if they were cool-headed enough to recruit a double agent, a Jordanian, to go right into this CIA base and take out some pretty high-ranking local CIA officers there.
Indeed. But the point here is this, is we shouldn't just focus on the, you know, particulars of the terrorism aspect. This is a technology that, you know, for example, Bill Gates said it was equivalent to the computer in 1980. So we're seeing it introduced into counterterrorism, just like the computer was used for data mining, but also cyber warfare. But we're seeing it all over the place in everything from policing to other military operations to use at home.
P.W. Singer's book is Wired for War. He's got a very up-close view of the realities and implications of robotic warfare. We're in it right now. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the changing face of war in the age of the robot, robotic warfare. P.W. Singer joins us from Washington. He's author of Wired for War. It came out about a year ago, out in paperback now, and maybe more relevant now than ever, looking at the technology and the implications, most importantly, of what's going on. You can join the conversation. Are you following the rise of robot war in the air, on the ground? Have you done it? Fought side by side with or on the ground under robots, drones in Iraq, Afghanistan, from CIA headquarters? Do you welcome this new tool of war or fear it? Peter Singer, we've got a lot of people who want to speak with you, and I'll turn to them in just a moment. And the implications here are endlessly fascinating. But give us a quick tour, if you would, at this point. Here we are at the beginning of 2010, sort of tour of the technology horizon here. What's going on and what's coming when it comes to robotic warfare?
Well, I think there's three big changes that are playing out, and we've got to be clear here. We're using an immense amount of them already. We already have 7,000 unmanned systems in the air and 12,000 on the ground. But the changes are a couple. We're first seeing them change in their size, shape, and form. So we're seeing prototypes of, for example, robotic planes that have wings the length of a football field that are designed to stay in the air, not just for hours, not just for days, not just for weeks, but literally years, to very small, teeny tiny robots, literally bugs with bugs, electronic devices the size of an insect designed to, for example, surveil, spy on someone. The second big change is in the intelligence of the systems and the autonomy. They're getting much smarter, and we're giving them more leash to carry out their operations on their own. And then the final is the function that we're having them do. A good parallel here, I think, is a lot like the early airplane back in World War I. You know, it was first designed just for observation, and then someone said, hold it, we can see the bad guys, want to do something about it. And so they jury-rigged, armed them, and then they specially designed them to be bomber planes, and then they said, hold it, they've got bomber planes, we've got bomber planes, we need to shoot each other down, and so they designed fighter planes. And then all of a sudden you saw planes being used for everything from cargo to medevac to passengers to mail delivery. Well, the same thing is played out with unmanned systems. The Predator was originally designed just for observation. The next one that came was the Reaper that was designed to actually fire weapons. And then now we see prototypes for cargo robotic systems, medevac ones, you name it. And so a wide range of functions.
And at the Pentagon, is enthusiasm on an upswing, downswing level? Is this seen as the future of American warfare or just an adjunct, a sort of sidecar?
The Pentagon budget is going to be flat for the next coming decade, as much as we can predict. But there's one part of it that's going to see growth, and that's unmanned systems. The Air Force, for example, says officially that one-third of all the planes it's going to buy in the future will be unmanned. That's probably a conservative prediction. For example, this year, the Air Force will train more unmanned systems operators than it will manned fighter plane and manned bomber plane pilots combined. And so this is seen as very much the future. But the real debate is trying to figure out what's appropriate to turn over to robots and what's inappropriate. And that's where the battle lines are being drawn.
We'll talk about it all. A lot of callers want to join us. P.W. Singer is with me. His book is Wired for War. John's calling from Medford, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Good morning. How are you?
Well, what do you know, John?
I'm a former military officer, 20 years in the military, and I fly for an airline now, and I also flew in the military. And I think it's unfortunate. I'd like to say P.W. Singer's book is probably one of the best, probably is the best book on the subject today. I mean, I haven't read anything else.
I'm not related to Tom in any way. Thanks, Tom.
It's a great book. It's true.
I haven't read anything that even comes close to the information that he has. But as Americans, we are so enamored with technology and how, you know, any gizmo we can get our hands on. I mean, I'm talking on an iPhone through a headset. Mm-hmm. I have an iPod. I mean, the military and our special operations and our intelligence agencies rely on this stuff to a point where our language skills have gone to nothing. Our human intelligence is what I believe got those unfortunate individuals in Afghanistan killed. We've lost the human element of it, and if we don't get it back, we don't get our language skills, we can have all the technology in the world. We lost in Vietnam. I've been in Iraq. I lived in the Middle East for 3 years. They rely very little. I mean, they use cell phones only when they absolutely think they have to. Everything's by word of mouth. So if we don't start getting people boots on the ground and individuals who can speak the local language and know what's going on, I don't think we really, I mean, we can bomb them. Afghanistan's in the Stone Ages. I don't know if we could go any further back than that, but we can bomb people till, you know, it's whatever, but we just can't. We're not going to get anywhere unless we can get the hearts and minds as well, I say.
And, John, but you were a military pilot. You'd rather put your life on the line than put a drone in the sky?
Well, I worked in...
Or neither.
I would rather actually put my life on the line. I flew out of Tsar, Hungary, during Sarajevo and Tuzla and Kosovo. We worked hand-in-hand with the drones as they were leaving and coming in. And, again, you know, you've got some guy in... outside of Nellis at the Air Force Base, the old Air Force Base, looking through a camera. He's been sitting there for 12 hours. Is he going to, you know, I mean, if he's absolutely certain, without somebody on the ground to designate for his hellfire or actually see who's in that car or in that building or whatever, you know, you just can't, you can unleash all the missiles you want, but we're killing civilians as well as the insurgents.
John, we got the perspective loud and clear, and I appreciate it. P.W. Singer, what do you say to the pilot John's testimony there?
He's making some great points, and I think there's two things that come out of that that are really important here. One is that aspect of technology gives you amazing advantages that were like science fiction before, but it isn't a silver bullet. It doesn't solve all your problems. So, for example, the sensors on the Predators and the new Reapers, they are incredibly powerful. They can far more than you or I, our human vision can see, you know, see great distances over a mile, but not only see great distances, but see things that the human eye can't see. So, for example, using this system, you can be overhead of an insurgent who, a group of insurgents, and you can pick out which ones are carrying an AK-47. And of those that are carrying an AK-47, which one recently fired that weapon by the heat signature that it gives off. So literally you can pick out the one who pulled the trigger just a couple minutes ago. But it doesn't help you, for example, win the hearts and minds of that individual or know whether that insurgent, for example, is actually thinking about turning over to the other side. The way, you know, we talk about the surge, the success of the surge in Iraq. Well, the success of the surge wasn't just having boots on the ground. It was the Sunni awakening. It was the fact that the insurgents there who had been fighting us decided to turn on Al-Qaeda. And so that's the kind of thing that the technology doesn't give you that insight into. And there's another part of it, and this is one of the things I really wrestle with in the book, is that this technology is revolutionary. It's powerful. It's a game changer. But people adjust. People catch up. And we've seen that in history. You know, one of the examples from history was if you were living in Peru, what is now Peru, about 500 years ago, these strange beasts came at you one day. They had four legs. They had the upper body of a man. They wore these suits of metal. They had sticks that fired smoke that could kill. They were magical. They were so scary that 200 of them put an army of 80,000 Incan warriors to flight.
Armored 200 Spaniards on horseback.
Exactly. We're talking about the conquistadors.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
But that incredible technology, gunpowder, they adjusted. And just a couple years later, the Incans launched an insurgency. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And they were able to wear down the Spaniards for a long period of time. And so things that seem like magic, humans adjust to. And that's true whether we're talking about gunpowder or whether we're talking about robots today.
And it's not only Americans developing robotic warfare capacity.
Exactly. And that's one of the other things is that we, you know, see ourselves as a very technologic society, but that may be an antiquated vision. That may be a 20th century vision. You know, when companies are putting out new technologies and they want to test it in the market, they don't test it in the U.S. anymore. They test it in countries like Korea and Japan. And so one of the things in the book is a chapter where I went around interviewing folks in different countries. And one of the most interesting interviews was of actually of a U.S. Air Force officer who is stationed in Japan. And his job is to keep an eye on what's going on in technology in Asia. And he's actually very worried, and not just about what's happening in Japan, but he has a line in the book where he says, quote, the Chinese are kicking our butts and we're sitting on our thumbs.
That is, the drone in the sky is not necessarily going to be an American drone. The British developed tanks, but then everybody got tanks. The U.S. may have robots today, but everyone can have them tomorrow, or many.
44 countries are building, buying, and using military robots today. So we shouldn't be so arrogant to think that we're always going to be ahead just because we're Americans. And that's a big worry of mine is that, you know, look at the trend lines. Where does the state of science and mathematics training in our schools? Where does the state of America's manufacturing industry have us headed? You know, is it on a positive trajectory or on those two sectors on a negative trajectory? And what does that mean for us? Those are some things to chew on.
Particularly if it's going to be a tech conflict through robots. Greg in Toma, Wisconsin. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. We love your program here.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I'm in agreement with several of the callers. When you say it's a game changer, I think that the use of drones is a colossal mistake in a war like this one. If we were fighting Hitler and we had an organized army to fight, I'd say use your drones and knock yourself out, do the best you can. But here, this is a war of ideology, of moral superiority, of people who, of us trying to show that we are a good and decent people, and yet we use drones, which show that we are cowards, if you will, and that we don't care who we kill. And I think it's going to just lead to a worsening of the situation.
Let us pick it up, Greg, and I thank you very much for your call. Peter Singer, what about the message in the technology? I mean, I do keep thinking about the soldiers who don't have to put their life on the line if the drone does it for them. I don't want to forget that, but there is also a message being sent in the means of combat.
It's a tough call. I mean, the caller, he has a strong point, but, you know, the opening scene in the book is the story of the very first robot being killed in action, killed, so to speak. And the commander of the unit sends a condolence letter back to the factory, not to someone's home. And he, in the condolence letter where he apologizes for not being able to bring that robot home, I mean, think about that for a minute, how weird that is. But he says in it, you know, I'm thankful for the fact that I didn't have have to write this letter to someone's mother. And so, you know, we can say, oh, we really should send troops in there. We shouldn't use these drones. But we have to face the fact that that would mean a lot more letters to people's mothers saying that their son or daughter has been killed in action. And that's why this technology isn't going away. But the caller hit on this other part of it, which is the ripple effect of how it's being interpreted. And some people interpret it as us being cowardly. Other people interpret it in very different ways. One of the updates in the book in the new version is interview I did of a U.S. Military. He was an individual within JSOC, our Joint Special Operations Command. And he talked about a meeting that they had with Pakistani tribal elders up in the Fata region. This is the region where bin Laden is reputed to be hiding out, where much of the drone strikes have happened. And at the meeting, they were served cookies. And this elder was enamored of this sweet-tasting bread that he'd never had before. And then the elder went on to complain of the Americans. And he didn't complain of civilian casualties. He actually said, your strikes are so precise. It's your enemy's houses are blowing up without a trace. And it, the complaint wasn't civilian casualties. It was, he said, you must have struck a deal with the devil to be able to do that. And the JSOC guy, you know, kind of laughingly says, look, you have someone who's never seen a cookie before. What do you expect him to interpret a predator drone strike as? Of course he's going to see it as black magic. And so this is one of these weird things that goes on when we talk about war of ideas. We can't just interpret it's our own ideas. There's multiple ideas at play here. And technology does have a ripple effect, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. It's the story that matters.
Including Mullah's saying, you know, this is American cowardice when it comes from the sky. Ned, Charlottesville, Virginia. Ned, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. This is a great show. I see this technology as another unfortunate layer insulating the public in America, the people who have the power, from the horrors of war. I would kind of ask, gee, what if we had a draft and we were taking upper-middle-class white kids and sending them over there out of college? How long do you think this, quote, war, end quote, would last? Not very long, and the reason is that the administration and probably the military-industrial complex is doing everything it can to insulate us from this problematic thing they refer to as war, and they pretty much can do anything they want anytime they want to. So here you have something that they're calling a war, which from a legal institutional basis cannot be a war. It is not. There is no enemy that can surrender and sign an enforceable treaty. Therefore, legally, it must be a police action. And we're using these drones in a police action, and the enemy is nothing like Hitler or anybody that it would be appropriate to use that from. Our sovereignty is not at risk.
But the insulation from war is very clear. Our time is short before the break. But, Peter, what do you say to Ned's observation?
I think he's got a point there. I mean, there is this insulating effect going on, and it was already happening without a draft. And this technology, you know, takes us to a new point. I mean, think about it this way. We haven't had a single congressional hearing about this technology or these use. Not one. Not just a let's learn about it a little more. So it's not so much a right-left issue as it is a new technology that, you know, challenges the way we had looked at the public relationship with war. There's another part of it I would say I would add on here. It doesn't insulate the public merely, though. It also is changing our relationship to war because this technology, it doesn't just remove you from risk. It records everything that it sees. And so we're also seeing the rise of what you can call YouTube war. That is people watching video clips of combat, not for information or news, but for fun. And I've gotten, you know, emails sent to me that show video clips of predator drone strikes that are set to music, like they're music videos. And that's a very odd but strange thing that's coming out of this.
That's pretty bizarre. You mean it must be guys who operate these who save the tapes and share them around?
Exactly. Anyone can go on Google right now and download video clips of combat. What does that say about the world that we're entering into?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the changing face of war in the age of the robot, robotic warfare, with P.W. Singer, author of Wired for War. It's just out in paperback, and the use of drones and robots on land in the sky has only grown in the year since it first came out. You can join the conversation. What's it mean when so much modern fighting is done by drones, by robots? And does war without humans mean war without conscience? And I guess this, are you in the robotic war business? What do you see? Sarah joins us from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air with P.W. Singer.
Hi, Tom. I was calling with response to an earlier caller who called to say that warfare in this way was kind of cowardly, and that your response was that it resulted in less letters home to people's mothers that their son or daughter had died in warfare. And it occurs to me that that's a drastic change in the concept of warfare, that you should be able to risk your life if you know that the other side involves the same thing. You know, it just doesn't make any sense for a soldier to go out not expecting to die. I mean, that's like a basic concept of warfare.
Sarah, it's a great observation, and P.W. Singer writes deeply to it in his book. Peter, I wish you'd respond. The issues of valor and conscience and heroism, but I guess ultimately conscience, get kind of erased here in the robotic era.
The reason this technology is revolutionary is these kind of questions, these kind of changing meanings of the terms of war that it's forcing upon us. Think about the concept of bravery. Bravery at one point in time meant the person who led the charge, you know, like Mel Gibson in Braveheart. And then we get the invention of gunpowder, and we suddenly war becomes these lines of men standing, firing muskets at each other. And so bravery is not leading the charge. It's standing in line, being not running away, taking a hit. It's like, you know, Mel Gibson in The Patriot. And then we get the machine gun, and to stand in line and just be shot at isn't bravery anymore. It's insanity. It's like, you know, Mel Gibson on a Malibu highway or something. And so what we have now is a whole new change where we have people who are carrying out acts of war and they don't even have to think about the old meanings of bravery. The only time they're risking themselves is in the commute and to work. And, you know, this, as the caller notes, you know, really does ask some powerful questions about not only, you know, something like bravery, but also questions of things like conscience or accountability, and how do the laws of war catch up to these ideas where one person may be risking themselves and the other isn't? And remember, when we're talking about the laws of war today, they were written several decades ago. In fact, the Geneva Conventions, if they were people, they would qualify for Medicare. And one of the things I write about in the book is how they're having a hard time keeping up with this new technology as well as the adversaries that they're being used against. So you have the Geneva Conventions in the middle that, you know, they came out the year that one of the biggest inventions was the 45 RPM record player. And we're trying to apply it to a technology like the Reaper drone. And then on the other hand, we're also trying to apply it to an insurgent who is hiding out in a hospital or a mosque. So the laws of war today are like under siege from both sides.
You write, from Homer's Achilles to Shakespeare's Henry V to your own grandfather in World War II, war and the life of the warrior was never simply just about killing. Rather, it was the ideals that lay behind, an accompanying sense of sacrifice, the acceptance that one might also have to die. You quote Paul Kahn at Yale Law School talking about the paradox of riskless warfare. I mean, one of the dangers seems to be that you could sort of do endless warfare, especially when, and here's a Paul on Facebook is saying, in the long run, how does this affect the privatization of the military industry? A lot of private hands are involved in the robotic warfare business. From Blackwater, Z, right on down.
Absolutely. And that's another one of these ripple effects is the demographics of war. Who can do what in war? And so this technology allows a whole new range of actors to take on a wider set of roles. And that's everything from having, you know, an 18-year-old high school dropout flying a plane. That's one of the individuals who appears in the book, to you don't even have to be in the military, trained in the military, wearing a uniform to be carrying out acts of war. And that's true whether you're talking about, for example, political appointees in the CIA who are basically running an air war in Pakistan, to private military contractors, which also have a huge role in this space. And one of the ironies that comes out of this is it's not just merely on the operation side, but there's an odd twist going on. Most of the maintenance and weapons loading of these systems is privatized. About 100% of Predator drone maintenance and 50% of Global Hawk maintenance and weapons loading is run by private companies. And so the result is that in these systems, the pilot is in uniform, but he's sitting back in Nevada. The person who is technically behind the lines, but they're actually at a base in Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan or elsewhere, they are a civilian. So we have the oddity that the person in uniform is in virtual danger and the civilian is in greater physical danger. And there's a lot of questions about their legal status and what happens if they're captured, all those sorts of things, let alone you get into the questions of what happens if a contractor commits a crime. And it's the same thing whether you're talking about a Blackwater guy running a convoy in Iraq or a Blackwater guy operating an unmanned system in the air. Same questions of accountability there.
It's morally complex. And yet I still think of that soldier on the ground when and if he or she might be helped by this, I guess. Eugene in Atlanta, Georgia. Eugene, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Yeah, this is the first time I've called the show, but I've deployed three times, 3 years, twice in Iraq and once in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the drones are great. We can use them as, you know, recons. I once had a buddy that was hit with an IED, and the drones actually located the people that, you know, set off the bomb.
Yeah,
set off the
charges. So, Eugene, when you're at war in Iraq or Afghanistan, are you often very conscious of the drones and your sort of robotic backup? Are you very aware of it?
Most of the times we are. And especially Afghanistan, where we're really spread out, I think those things help a lot as far as, you know, just an eye in the sky, especially the guys setting in the IEDs.
So when you hear people criticizing them because a drone has no soul, you know, it brings up moral issues, what do you say to that, Eugene?
Well, all I know is they help out a lot and they do save lives, and we work right with them on the ground. So, you know,
yep,
I'm 100%.
Eugene, we've got it, and I appreciate your call very much. We'll speak to it. Let me get Peter in Boston as well. Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, John, great program and interesting topic. I'm an old Marine combat veteran. I have to tell you, it needs to be discussed, but we're de-minimizing what's happening to the kids that are out there fighting now, the Marines and the Army guys.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a technological support to try to assist these, you know, assist these people who are engaged. I absolutely believe, like, universal service, that's not going to happen. But people who are now back in the rear in the States saying, well, they should, hey, somehow it's more noble for them to take a risk. Of course they're at risk now, but if you can have something to assist those guys and expose and knock out a position without a squad of Marines getting killed, they can knock it out with the Predator.
Yeah, yeah.
The same thing with going into Pakistan. Look what happened to that SEAL outfit about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. They were wiped out. You know, maybe the technology could have helped them. I think it's a, you know, a safe, when you sit back, you're an academic, you can sit back and you debate how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But when you,
or the morality of war, but I take your point.
But with the one who are fighting, the mm-hmm. actual guys who are fighting and dying,
mm-hmm.
those are the ones, I think, because, hey, it's the politics, we can vote and do changes, but we're at whatever you want to call it, war, police action. Kids are dying. A couple of Marines got killed a couple of days ago, and Army guys are getting killed.
Sure.
We need every advantage. You know, what do you, I mean, that's like saying, well, okay, hey, they're fighting with a sword. You put your hand behind your back? Well, you know, I mean, it's the type of thing, you know, if we have it, we are at war, we should do everything to try to de-minimize our casualties and help us get through the mission with the president wants to do in another year or so. If we, the one thing
yep.
people forget, the combat guys are out there to kill the people, number one. It's not winning heart and minds when you're in an infantry outfit and you're making an assault on a hill. I heard your guest say, well, that one who shot a weapon, could we win hearts and minds? I mean, it's so preposterous, and it's a classic of an academic. You've never been in war. Somebody shoots at you, you're not thinking about taking prisoner.
Peter, we got your perspective, and richly, I get the real fight, the blood and guts fight. I have to say, I guess there is a hearts and minds element here as well. I'm sure you'd ultimately agree. But let me take it to P.W. Singer. We've got here Eugene in Atlanta, you know, three tours, Iraq, Afghanistan, and he's awfully happy for that support from the drones. And Peter's saying, let's support the troops no matter what they need out there because they're fighting. We're not. What do you say, Peter?
Let me be explicitly crystal clear here. I am not saying don't use these systems. I'm saying wake up, people. There is a technologic revolution going on. We've gone from having a handful of these drones, none of them armed, to now we have 7,000 in the air. We've gone from having zero of them on the ground to 12,000. The things that we used to talk about as being science fiction, they're here. And because of what your callers are talking about, they're not going away. They are viewed as incredibly useful in war. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of American soldiers who are alive today because of these systems. So I'm not saying get rid of them, don't use them. I'm saying wake up, they're here. But there's another aspect of this. This ain't the Rumsfeld era anymore. There is no silver bullet solution to all our problems. And so if the parallel is that this is, you know, one of the callers said it's, you know, it's like a sword, guess what? It's also a double-edged sword. So their ripple effect that come out of using this technology that we have to own up to and figure out answers to them. And some of them are the fact that what we view as effective and powerful, a local tribal leader who we want to win their hearts and minds so that the war does end, doesn't view it that way. Or, for example, we've used more and more of this technology, but we didn't think about the information security of this technology. So we have this powerful drone that was allowing someone like Eugene to be protected by that all-seeing eye in the sky. But guess what? They didn't encrypt the data communications of that, so they recently found out that Iraqi insurgents were also watching the same video coming off of our all-seeing eye in the sky. Or another example of kind of the tough questions that come out of this is we have to think about it's not just being used at war now, it's also starting to be used at home. The Predator drone started out as a military technology, but Department of Homeland Security is using it. We have local police departments like in Miami that are starting to explore the use of drones in the air. And that raises legal questions. And so my point is we're not getting rid of this technology. It's rather, it's like the computer, it's like the airplane, it's like the tank. It's something new. It's raising tough questions. It's the questions we better figure out the answers to.
Time to get to grips with it, says P.W. Singer. Let's go to Cape Coral, Florida. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I had a question because I'm in pest control, and about 3 years ago, I used to spray some guy's house who was part of a group across the United States. He was a group of five guys that I found out who were actually internet terrorists, as I would look at them now, because 3 years ago, I really didn't think about it too much, but I never really reported any of these guys because I didn't exactly know who to talk to, but they would show me and stuff that they would do as far as hacking into the government stuff. And I wonder how secure are these drones from being taken over from a group such as these people? I know that they were kind of spread out and they all had their own individual purpose in the group.
Yeah, Michael, we got it. P.W. Singer, what about how secure is control? We know the instance that you cited folks on the ground who hacked in with very cheap software and were looking down from American drones, and this was the enemy in that theater. But what about control more widely and the issue of, you know, having your robots turned around on yourself?
So what happened in Iraq that was reported widely a couple weeks ago is a lot like someone listening in on a police radio scanner. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people do it for entertainment and sometimes it's criminals who listen in to know if the cops are coming. And that's why the police now encrypt their radio scanners. But the problem is this technology came on so quickly and they really didn't have an operating plan for it. That communication wasn't encrypted. Now, it wasn't the controls of it. So it wasn't like a Hollywood movie where someone was taking over the control of the systems. But that is a type of warfare that we're moving into very soon. I describe it as that we have the possibility of what you could call battles of persuasion. That is, you know, think about a pilot of a fighter plane. Think about, you know, Tom Cruise in Top Gun. We couldn't, you know, call up Tom Cruise in Top Gun and say, all right, see all the American F-14s, recode them as enemy MiG-29s and shoot them down. Mm-hmm. He would just, you know,
say
that's
it.
Absurd.
Mm-hmm.
He'd say forget it. Computer software, though, will say, you know, affirmative. It will allow that recoding if you're able to take it over. And so that's the dangers of the combination of cyber warfare with growing use of unmanned systems, is that the system might be able to be persuaded to do things that a human would not be persuaded to.
I mean, we read about waves of cyber attacks on Pentagon computer systems. They seem to be almost nonstop these days.
This, I mean, in a certain way, we're already at cyber war. I remember meeting with just one company. It was a defense company, and they described that they had over 20,000 different types of attempts or attacks on them every month in cyber. And of those, they described that there were six cohesive, they called them campaigns. That is, it wasn't just, you know, one dude who was trying to hack for fun. It was a state-sponsored organization that was deliberately trying to enter into their system day after day after day, a group of these. And so this is another, you know, change that's going on in war. We have these antiquated views of war that it's just men who meet in the middle of a field. Well, it's not that way anymore. It's ugly, it's dirty, and it's also moving into new realms of technology that we never imagined before. And that's why we, the public, need to become a lot better informed and understanding of this, because otherwise very bad decisions are made in our name.
But the trend line that you describe is deeper into this robotic warfare terrain. You don't see that one turning around.
No, absolutely not. As one of the people that I interview in the book, he's a U.S. military officer, and he jokingly says, you know, once the farm boy sees Paris, he doesn't go back. And no one is talking about getting rid of all of these unmanned systems after, you know, if the war ends in Afghanistan and Iraq. No, this is viewed as the future. We're going to buy more and more of them. And again, not just utilizing them in war, but also all sorts of other areas. And it's not just America, 44 countries out there. And it's a lot like the invention of the airplane or the computer. It's a game changer in terms of not its capabilities, but the tough questions it's forcing us in society to ask.
P.W. Singer in Washington, thank you very much for your work, and thanks for being with us today, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
P.W. Singer, director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution. He's author of Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.